Well, while Satan obviously is evil, there's no question of that, and in rebellion to God, he is not unintelligent. He is often very crafty, very manipulative, and impressively well-organized. I'm not complimenting here. I'm simply stating facts, okay? We're not trying to say, wow, this is impressive. But he is efficient, and he is effective. But he's also limited in what he can do, and he derives his power from people. When people listen to him and succumb to his devices and his lies and his deceptions, he gains momentum. And when people refuse to listen to him, then he loses ground. And we have this passage here that you're probably familiar with at the end of talking about, you know, withholding forgiveness for a brother who has repented and so on. Paul says this statement here. He says, "No advantage should be taken of us by Satan, for we are not ignorant of his schemes." Which is another way of saying, we shouldn't be ignorant of his schemes, right? I mean, there's a message here that really is very powerful. We're not supposed to be ignorant of his ploys or his methods here. And this instruction, by the way, is not limited to preachers. It's not limited to elders. It's not limited to a select few who decide to, you know, engage in that kind of instruction and so on. But anyone who is a Christian, namely you, if you are a Christian here tonight, then it's directed toward you. You are not to be ignorant of Satan's schemes in your life. The gospel of Christ is under attack today, but it cannot be defeated. It can be misused, it can be misquoted, and it can be misunderstood, but it cannot actually be changed. God's truth is invincible, it is indestructible, it is immutable, and God defends that truth with his own power. That having been said, you are the one that can be changed. You are the variable. And we cannot abandon the truth and succumb to Satan's lies or errors. We realize that Satan is no match for Christ, or at least we should know that. On the other hand, we can abandon that truth and we can be the weakest link here and become his primary target. You cannot afford to be unprepared, in other words. We are supposed to defend the truth, not contribute to its misrepresentation, either through our negligence, our failure to study, or our failure to suit up with the full armor of God, which I will mention near the end of this lesson. Here's the thing. Satan does not care if you are a Christian. He really doesn't. As long as you are ineffective and unproductive. He doesn't care if you wear the name of Christ. He doesn't care if you call yourself a Christian. He doesn't care if you go to church and if you give liberally and pray to God and all those other things. So the question is, are you prepared? Are you prepared to defend against Satan? You cannot be prepared to resist him and his followers if you are unaware of his schemes. Thus, our lesson tonight. One of Satan's oldest and most effective schemes is simply divide and conquer. When Christians are united by Christ and his doctrine, we are a formidable opponent. But when we are divided, we become weak and ineffective. Someone says, well, what divides us? Well, I'm going to give you a few things. This is not an exhaustive list whatsoever, but these are some of the perhaps more obvious things. And so at least these things. First of all, when any one person's view or opinion is allowed to dominate the entire congregation, that is divisive. In other words, when there is no room for dialogue or dissent, you either agree or you are asked to leave or you are marked as a troublemaker. I'm not talking about doctrine here, but we're really dealing with opinions that essentially become tests of fellowship. You have to agree with this test of fellowship or you don't have fellowship with us. And in some cases, people will be so bold as to say you don't have fellowship with Christ if you don't agree to our test of fellowship. In 3 John chapter 1, because there is only one chapter, in verse 9 and 10, John says something here interesting to us. He says, and keep in mind, John is an apostle of Christ and Diotrephes is not. He says, I wrote something to the church, but Diotrephes, who loves to be first among them, does not accept what we say. For this reason, if I come, I will call attention to his deeds, which he does, unjustly accusing us with wicked words. And, not satisfied with this, he himself does not receive the brethren either, and he forbids those who desire to do so and puts them out of the church. There are a lot of modern Diotrephes out there, men or women or both, who act in this very same way. Satan loves to operate through the self-serving tyranny of certain Christians. So think about this. That is one method that Satan uses to divide us. Another method is this. When sin is discovered in our midst, but then there is not a unified effort to deal with it. In other words, when some will support the person who is engaged in sin for whatever reason, and then try to shield that person. This often happens in families. I'm talking about physical families now, within the congregation. One family member is in sin, but the rest of the family rises up to defend, to justify, to explain, to protect, or to minimize and say, it's really not so bad what's happening here. And that person who's done the deed there, as well as those who support that person, pit themselves against the elders and the leadership of the church who are really trying hard to carry out their moral responsibility. And this causes all kinds of grief, needless grief, and trouble. In essence, those who are trying to deal with the sin become the bad guys. And the guy who's causing all the trouble becomes a victim. I mean, in other words, the roles get reversed in a sense. And that's one of Satan's ploys, is to do exactly that. Or when zeal and diligence to study and enthusiasm to pursue God or draw near to God is replaced by a certain number within the group with neglect and indifference and apathy. That is another one of Satan's strategies. And the reason for that is because that group, however small or large it is, becomes basically an anchor around the neck of the congregation and drags them down, weighs them down, just dead weight. And that creates unnecessary but painful division within the congregation. Now I'm going to stop right here and ask ourselves pointedly, is any of that happening here? No hands or comments, that's not the point. But ask yourself, is any of these things happening here? Because if any of it is happening, then what we are doing as a group is we're giving power to Satan. And we're minimalizing our own efforts. We are reducing our influence and giving Satan all the advantage. We cannot be effective if we are divided. And yet our only source of unity can be Christ and His Word. We cannot be united by other things. I mean, in reality, we can be united by those, but it's the wrong kind of unity. I should say it really that way. And it's not something that comes from God. And if we are not united with Christ and in Christ, then that means we are sitting ducks for takeover and all kinds of problems. In other words, we become a congregation in decline, not a congregation that is going to succeed. All right, so that's one thing, divide and conquer. Here's another one of Satan's schemes, the normalizing of wicked behavior or immoral behavior. This is not often something that arises from within the group, but is often the result of outside forces and influences. In other words, and as you well know, secular society keeps cramming its agenda down our throat till we just finally get resigned to it, we shrug our shoulders and go, what's the use? I'm tired of fighting it. Okay? And this is a strategy that Satan used, keeps pummeling us basically with this sort of thing. A clear example of this is the increasing acceptance of homosexual behavior among those who call themselves Christians in Christian churches. Deviant behavior now being called acceptable and normal, sometimes even superior to heterosexual relationships because they love more deeply and understand and connect more and whatever else is said of them. In several denominations, in fact, practicing homosexuals enjoy full fellowship. In fact, in some denominations, they enjoy leadership positions. This is simply a result of what has been happening in our society over at least the last 30 years. Homosexuality is no longer taboo or condemned or rejected by mainstream culture. It is now acceptable, normal, and commonplace. For example, virtually every TV series has its token homosexual character or characters. Some series, actually the main character or characters are homosexual, and the entire plot revolves around their homosexuality. I want you to think about what's going on here. We as a society have become numb to the deviancy of this behavior. When I was a child, which wasn't that long ago, but when I was a child, homosexuality was anything but normal. Everything has reversed polarity now. Everything has. And you're saying, well, what happened? Well, society got numb and overwhelmed, and then the churches themselves are following suit. And that is part of Satan's strategy. I want you to think about now what Paul says, for example, in the passage that was read to us, 1 Corinthians chapter 5. Keep in mind what he's talking about. He says it's reported that there's immorality among you. And instead of responding to that how you should have, you have become arrogant and have not mourned instead, so that the one who had done this deed should be removed from your midst. That's what should have happened. And he calls that later on in the chapter wicked behavior. And he says you ought not to ever have fellowship with such a man, but put him out of your midst. Immorality, or fornication that is used here, literally refers to any illicit or deviant sexual activity, including adultery, incest, premarital sex, bestiality, and homosexuality. Anything that violates the natural order of creation. In other words, how God created us to be and how to function within a certain relationship, specifically in marriage. Paul is saying to the Corinthians, this activity, whatever it is forbidden among God's people, and yet you guys are treating it like it's no big deal. No one is taking action. No one is speaking out. No one is demanding repentance. Essentially, no one is standing in the gap. And instead of mourning over this man's situation, you become arrogant. You become proud and resistant and even defiant. Like, yeah, we have this man among us, so what? The point here is it doesn't matter what society says is normal. If God has condemned a behavior, then it will always be condemnable and sinful to us. Let society do what it's going to do, because it's going to do it anyway. We have, in essence, a strict code of ethics and a strict code of morality. We have got to abide by that, otherwise we cease to be Christians. We cease to be God's people, by definition. We can take the name, but it doesn't mean that we're living the life. Another one of Satan's schemes is the secularization of the church. This is where we become more focused on social reform than on spiritual renewal. We become more focused on social causes than on righteousness. And we become more focused on addressing the ills and injustices of society than we do discipleship. The reason I'm bringing this up is because many churches out there that call themselves Christian churches have truly abandoned their commitment to Christ for causes and crusades and the politics of secular society. And I want to tell you that the liberal media loves this. Because when we're doing this, or when they're doing this, that means less religion and more community service. That means less talk about the Bible, which always ends in controversy, right? And more talk about civil rights and support for minority groups. Less talk about God and Christ, more division and controversy. More talk about social reform, environmentally friendly solutions, and of course, liberal politics. Liberal media loves it when churches basically capitulate to that kind of perspective there. And as a result of that, churches are expected to provide social welfare services, financial handouts to whoever calls and asks for them, food kitchens, seminars on dealing with social ills, town meeting type forums, entertainment and recreation like movie nights, celebrity singers, dramatic plays, sponsoring of sports teams to keep people off the streets so they don't get bored and into trouble, right? In essence, what we're supposed to become is a community center for those who are in need, those who are misdirected, or those who are simply outright bored. That has become the Christian church of the 21st century, at least to some. And it is spreading. It is becoming more widespread. In Luke chapter 19, verse 10, Jesus says, "The Son of Man has come to seek and to save that which is lost." You wonder what Jesus' mission was. Well, he spells it out for you succinctly, at least in this passage. And this means that Jesus was not interested in social reform, in a secular agenda, or in gaining popular approval. If he was after popular approval, he took the entirely wrong route to it, right? Jesus' mission was extremely clear, and he did not allow himself to get sucked into every petty argument, social issue, family drama, moral dilemma, or otherwise that people confronted him with. And it also means that he did not compromise his mission with things that have nothing to do with that mission. His objective is the spreading of God's message of hope and salvation to people who are destined for spiritual ruin if they don't do something about it. What is your mission? What is our mission? Think about that. In Acts chapter 26, verse 18, I think there's a very succinct definition of Jesus' mission in his own words. This is Paul saying what was told to him by Christ. Paul's mission was to open their eyes so that they may turn from darkness to light and from the dominion of Satan to God, that they may receive forgiveness of sins and an inheritance among those who have been sanctified by faith in me. Doesn't that sound like what we should be doing? Doesn't that sound like what Christians should be involved in all the time? Doesn't that sound like what the mission of the church should be, if you will? This is Christ's cause in his own words. It really ought to be ours. The question is it our mission? Or are we slowly succumbing to other lesser, inferior things? Another one of Satan's schemes is that of always putting Christians in defensive mode, where we're reacting versus taking the initiative. This may happen more on an individual level than on a congregational one, but it is still a problem nonetheless. And here's what happens. In essence, our critics, say atheists or humanists or agnostics or people from other religions, they make some derogatory, inaccurate, or offensive statement about Christians, or about you in particular, and we feel compelled to vindicate ourselves. Or, for example, someone posts some anti-Christian statement or comment on Facebook. Please, tell me it never happens, right? And you end up commenting on that, trying to, say, set the record straight or defend yourself, and pretty soon it turns into a virtual debate with half of your so-called friends. Think about this. This happens. Or, for example, someone asks you a question on religion or morality, but it's really just designed to be a bait or a trap to lure you into some long, drawn-out, mind-numbing discussion, which really isn't a discussion at all because they have no intention of budging from where they're at. They just want to drag you into something, and you bite. And so the next thing you do is you spend a deal of time and energy and research and looking up scriptures, and you expend blood and sweat to respond to this because you feel like, nobly, that you need to defend the gospel. But the fact is, you're wasting your time. You're wasting your energy. Now, you might look at this and say, well, then we shouldn't give a defense at all. I'm not saying that whatsoever. I'm not saying that you should never put forward such effort. What I am saying, however, is that we need to be discerning as to when and how to put forward such effort. We are told in Matthew chapter 7, verse 6, that we're not to throw our pearls before the swine and our holy things before the dogs. We're not the one that make those people swine or dogs. They are the ones who choose that themselves. But when those people define themselves in that way, when they reveal themselves for what they really are, you don't sit there and waste time on them. There's a lot of other people out there who are really, as we sang in the song tonight, desperate, begging to hear the gospel of truth. Those are the ones who you should be seeking. Don't fall victim to those who simply do not want to hear, will not listen, and have no intention of changing. Maybe you've fallen victim to some of this yourself. Finally, at least for this lesson, another one of Satan's schemes is to sow seeds of frustration and discouragement and feelings of what's the use among us or in ourselves. Because of this constant barrage of worldliness and godless people and overwhelming odds. In essence, Satan wants to exhaust our faith by relentlessly assaulting us with those things that constantly try our faith and require our attention and torment our soul and, yes, weigh heavy on our hearts. He knows that we're only human, and he knows, therefore, that we can only last so long before we either give in or give up. And he does not care, once again, if we remain Christian, as long as we fade into the background, put forward very minimal effort, shrug our shoulders and go, there's just no point in trying. That is exactly what he wants to hear. And when you say that, you have given all kinds of power and control to Satan and robbed yourself and the Lord of your influence. The fact is, Satan is partly right. We are limited. And we are prone to fatigue and being overwhelmed for that matter. And we can become frustrated and discouraged. And we will give in or we will give up if, and it's a big if left to our own strength and our own abilities. So if you're relying on yourself, it's just a matter of time. You will be crushed by Satan. It's just a matter of time. It's not a matter of if, it's just a matter of when. But this is where Satan gives only half the story. Our strength must never rest upon ourselves, but it must rest upon what God supplies. Read Ephesians chapter 6, verse 10 through 13. Well, we got a couple minutes. Let's just turn over there and see what Paul says in this particular passage, because it's a powerful one and it's very appropriate. In Ephesians chapter 6, starting in verse 10, Paul says, "Finally, be strong in the Lord and in the strength of his might. Put on the full armor of God so that you will be able to stand firm against the schemes of the devil. For our struggle is not against flesh and blood, but against the rulers, against the powers, against the world forces of this darkness, against the spiritual forces of wickedness in the heavenly places. Therefore, take up the full armor of God that you will be able to resist in the evil day, and having done everything, to stand firm." Stand firm, therefore. Three times in this short passage, Paul has said, stand firm. But he's also said, stand firm in the Lord. And stand firm in the strength of his might. He doesn't just say, go out there and stand firm. Make sure you fight and hold your post. What he says is, you need to be grounded in the Lord. And we are to put on the full armor of God if we are going to be prepared and outfitted to do battle. This is not through our own means, then. It's through that which God supplies. The question is not, do we have a full armor of God? The question is not, has God provided the full armor? The question really is, are you putting it on daily? Because if you're not putting on this armor, then you will succumb in due time. It's not a matter of if. It's a matter of when. And this goes hand in hand with our daily effort to be good people, in essence. Paul says here in Galatians chapter 6, verse 9 and 10, "Let us not lose heart in doing good, for in due time we will reap, if..." Big conditional statement there. "If we do not grow weary. So then, while we have opportunity, let us do good to all people, and especially those of the household of the faith." Well, what if we do grow weary? Well, then we are going to succumb to Satan's tactics, and we're going to succumb to that assault, that constant, relentless barrage of things that he throws at us. So pray for God's strength. Rest upon that strength. Believe that he actually will help you. Hebrews chapter 10, verse 35 and 36. "Therefore," the writer says, "do not throw away your confidence, which has a great reward, for you have need of endurance, so that when you have done the will of God, you may receive what was promised." Well, that also is a conditional statement. If you have done the will of God, then you will receive what was promised. But what if you haven't done the will of God? What if you gave up or gave in or didn't put on the full armor of God, even though he provided it for you? What if you were trying to be strong in your own might rather than strong in the might of the Lord? You see where this is going. Satan knows your weaknesses probably better than you know them yourself. And he targets those weaknesses and he exploits those weaknesses. He knows exactly what to do to make you succumb. You need to fix your eyes on Christ so that you will not be hoodwinked, in essence, by Satan. Well, we're supposed to be aware of Satan's schemes and not fall victim to them. But the fact is, we are not smarter than him, nor are we stronger than him. But Christ is smarter, and he is stronger. And we must appeal then to his wisdom and his strength rather than to our own. Satan wants to compromise our effectiveness by dividing and conquering us, or by throwing us into a series of no-win situations, or seeming no-win anyway, or making us squirm with discomfort, or making us second-guess our convictions, or portraying us as bad guys when we're really not. And his strategy is to disorganize us, or to distract us from our true mission, or to force us into retreat in fear and shame. The question is, what are you going to do about that? What are we, as a congregation, going to do about that? Do we have a plan? Or are we just winging it? thinking that we can come to church and go through our routine here, put forward our minimal effort, and then go back out in the world thinking that we're fully prepared when in fact we might not be. What are we doing? We, individually as well as collectively, have to remain focused and intent upon our objective. And our objective is not to save the world, by the way. Our objective really is to save one soul at a time. That really is our objective. And to draw near to God and not succumb to Satan's schemes. That is, should be your personal objective as well. Question is that what you're doing? Are you drawing near to God? Or are you slowly and almost imperceptibly, but nonetheless, in reality, succumbing to Satan's schemes? Where are you at? I don't know who's where in all this. That's not my job. My job is to tell you that we need to not be taken advantage by Satan, and we are to be aware of his schemes and his ploys. You are to be aware of those things. Because if you're not aware of them, then you're going to fall victim to them. And that simply is not acceptable. If you need to respond to our lesson tonight for whatever reason, then we invite you to come forward while we stand and sing the song that Richard has selected for us.